Crooked Lake, Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Powerhouse vocalism is that of Ivy Ford, and I have so enjoyed getting to know this marvelous musician and singer, and now I'm excited about the opportunity to speak with her. Ivy Ford and her group, the Ivy Ford Band, are going to be one of the headliners for the upcoming Harbor Park Jazz and Rhythm and Blues Festival in Kenosha. And that is coming up on Saturday, the 20th of August. And it's going to be a wide array of musical acts that are represented, first-rate musicians by and large. And the Ivy Ford Band promises to provide some of the greatest excitement of the whole event. And Ivy Ford herself has had a really, really interesting career. And although she is a relative youngster in the field, she's still has already accomplished quite a lot and made music with some really important legends. So we have a lot to talk about. Ivy Ford, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi.
Glad to be talking with you. Yeah, I'm glad to be talking with you. First of all, it's probably important for people to know that you are from around here. You're from right down the road, born and raised in little old Waukegan, Illinois. Explain at what point in your life in Waukegan that music started to play such a mighty role in your life and who you are.
Well, I was always, since a very young age, I was always into music. I mean, I was at 5 and 6 years old, I was doing the school talent shows and whatnot. And I was, you know, in band and in choir and in school all through high school. So I've always been, it's always been a part of me. And I was really fortunate that my mom was always very encouraging, you know, of that. And it wasn't until I was probably, it wasn't until I was about 12 or 13, actually, is when I actually was going out to see live music, say, like at restaurants or different community festivals, which was actually primarily out of Kenosha at the time, ironically enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that kind of brings into where I really was starting to sing with live bands and getting a taste of music in a more professional sense. And it wasn't until I was about, I think it was, 12 years old where I actually first had saw the band The Real Deal, which is actually out of Kenosha, Racine, and they still play now. And that's a band that's originally fronted and put together by Steve Rainey, also known as The Rain Man, who is a fantastic drummer. And I say pretty much my first and biggest mentor of being a musician. And I had seen them, I think, either at, it was either at like a community event or maybe a Sunday afternoon at like a bar restaurant type of thing. And they had actually asked me to sit in with them and sing a song or two. And it was like all uphill from there, you know, so.
I know that you are a singer and also an instrumentalist, and you've mostly, I think your website says you are mostly self-taught on piano, alto sax, drums, guitar, bass guitar. Was that always the case, or did you start out with one particular sort of musical focus for yourself as a performer and then sort of branched out with all of these other things coming in? Or from the start, were you always first and foremost a singer, or did this start with the instruments?
Sure. Well, like I said, when I was in school and stuff, in grade school and so on, I was always singing. So that was always my thing. I was always a vocalist, and I like to sing. And the reason why I picked up piano, which was my first instrument, was I wanted to be able to play for myself, you know, so I wouldn't have to worry about, say, getting a CD with a background track or having other musicians. In addition to, I always wanted to play piano as a young kid anyway, you know. So that was some of the first motivations to play any sort of instrument. And I had gotten a few lessons from a local lady when I was about 9. And I took lessons for just under a year, just some beginner work. And after that, just from circumstances, I had stopped taking lessons, but always continued with kind of advancing my education, so to speak, on my own terms. And then when I got into intermediate school, where, you know, band was an option, that's where I picked up saxophone. And so it was piano and saxophone as a young kid. And then when I started getting into seeing bands and whatnot and, say, going to open jams that were local and stuff, that's where I picked up guitar. Because what would happen is, as a singer, you know, it stereotypically, they would, it's kind of said that what happens where people, guitar players, and I only say this lovingly because I'm a guitar player myself, sometimes they overlook vocalists in that kind of setting, you know. So I picked up guitar just a little bit, kind of because I, again, wanted to be able to play for myself and not have to rely on other musicians, say, at an open jam setting or whatnot, you know. And then other than that, I picked up instruments here and there, like bass and drums, just out of pure kind of curiosity, and just I liked it, you know. So
no better reason to explore something. When we watch you, when we watch video of you, you have an amazing charisma and a confidence in the spotlight that is really exceptional. I'm curious. I know that you were already performing with The Real Deal as a young teenager, maybe 13 years old, something like that, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. From the start, did you have this really confident persona in the spotlight, or is that something you've had to nurture over the years?
It's definitely been pretty natural from the get-go. I mean, I remember my first my first say talent show, and granted this is a, you know, that's a different different setting, but still relative. I was five years old, and I was singing in a community talent show at an outdoor band show, and I forget, something that happened where the performers before me ended up having to cancel or something, so I ended up having to open up the talent show. And I know a lot of people were like, at the time they said, just this five-year-old girl, and isn't she nervous? And I remember telling my mom, I said, I was so excited. And I was, you know, like I said, I was five then, and I remember even now absolutely being completely comfortable, and I get excited, you know, I get excited, and I tell people now when I get compliments from my fans and audiences, and they say, oh, we've had such a good time, or we love the music, I tell them, it's an energy that when my audience has a good time and stuff like that, it's very mutual and it goes back and forth. So I've been very fortunate that it's just, I don't know what it is, there's just a certain switch that it becomes second nature, and I feel probably most comfortable when I'm performing or on stage more than anything. You know?
That's sure what it looks like. Do I remember that you are in your early 20s?
Yes, I turned 23 in February.
Okay. One of the things I have read repeatedly about you and about your career is that for someone so young, you have an exceptional veneration for the past, for the classics, for tradition. and I suspect that maybe springs from a couple of different things, but I know one of the hallmarks of your career is that you have actually made music with some really legendary people in the business.
I've gotten to witness, I've gotten to share stages with a few folks, and some of them are good friends, you know, a few of them are good friends of mine, you know, so which that definitely helps. They've been nice mentors in my life, you know.
Right. How about that attention to tradition and that interest in musicians who've come before you? Not all young people have that. You know, some people are just very much caught up in what they're doing and trying to create something completely new with no sense of a wider tradition that it's connected with.
Sure.
Do you have any idea of where that interest in and appreciation for the past comes from for you?
For lack of a more extensive isolation, I could say, like, well, my mama just raised me right. But no, you know, I've always had a really strong appreciation for a lot of quote unquote older music. Just in general, it appeals to my aesthetic a little bit more. And then as far as the actual musicianship, and me as a person developing and becoming, you know, a young adult and a young artist and things like that, I've always been around a lot of, I'd say, more seasoned musicians or older people. And I, for whatever reason, I just have always felt the need to be very respectful to those, you know, that are above me or have a little bit more experience or older than me, you know, as I say, respect your elders. So I think that's just been kind of second nature to do so, which, with that being said, it's allowed me to, you know, kind of sit back and learn something, which I've witnessed, whether it's music or whether it's just having good manners and being a good person. Obviously, generationally wise, unfortunately, these days, sometimes, you know, the young people or whatever, you know, they call it millennials and things like that, they kind of forget that. And so I think that has a strong, is a strong influence of why I kind of have the perspective. And but with that being said too, I definitely, there's a good time to have appreciation for older things and you know, like you said, people that have come before me and that musicianship and that artistry. And with that being said, that's where you need, those are tools that you need to have in order to do something different or a little new or better as well, you know. So it goes hand in hand. You need the old to have good foundations, and you need to have some self-confidence and some self kind of innovation to do something a little bit different or more progressive as well.
Very well put. I like that. I like that a lot. Say a word about the city of Chicago and what it has meant to you. I mean, its musical scene.
My head was traditional, but that sounds, I don't think that's appropriate. I think it's the cross between the words roots, foundation, and a certain, kind of family generation to it, you know? Because when I think of that, you know, I play in Chicago a lot, but obviously I'm from more of the suburbs, but Chicago is very, very home to me. And I have a lot of quote unquote, friends and musician family that are in Chicago or that I know, you know, we play in Chicago, and there's just a certain sense of pride or tradition, I guess. Within Chicago, and I say that with relating to music, especially and specifically blues music too, you know, blues and classic rock for sure.
So, at the age of 23, you have a lot of your life stretching ahead of you, and many years of professional music making ahead of you. Do you have any idea where this is going? Do you have certain aspirations, maybe potential kind of new paths you might explore? Or in a sense, do you feel very fulfilled with what you're doing right now? And do you imagine that being sort of your professional bread and butter for a long time to come?
Well, I definitely, you know, I would say the last two years, I've really had some mile markers and some milestones and good experience that have allowed me to do a little bit of traveling. Just, you know, and I say traveling meaning within the States, you know, nothing crazy. And I've been fortunate that I've been having a very consistent and current appeal to, you know, my listeners and whatnot. So I'm very grateful and whatnot. But I do hope my goals, and sooner than later, I do hope to maybe get some more traveling in, more along the lines of doing some tours, you know, where there's consecutive bigger shows like festivals or big, you know, bigger venues, things like that. I really would like that. And even more so than that, I've yet to come out with a full album that was with a full band. That was all blues, so I'm actually working on one currently, but it's still under the construction point and still has a lot of work to do. But in a perfect world, and in the long run and bigger picture, I would like to be a very affluent, more recording artist, as well as doing some more tours, and who knows, even going, you know, overseas or whatnot, and doing some international stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I think the sky's the limit for someone with your kind of talent and your kind of drive and conviction. And we're excited to see what happens next. In the meantime, we're also really excited that you're going to be part of this next Harbor Park Jazz and Rhythm and Blues Festival in Kenosha on Saturday, August 20th. You are performing, I know, in the afternoon, and I know people are going to just be knocked flat by your music making. We encourage people with questions to go to www.mahonefund.org for more information on this year's Jazz and Rhythm and Blues Festival. And Ivy Ford, it's been great to talk with you, and we look forward to having you in Kenosha. Thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Oh, you're very welcome. Can treat me well. I want a man to make me feel good. And if you want some love and he can.
inside. Well, I'm on the search for my Mr. Right. Oh, say you're single, want some love.
It's 8:30 and you're listening to the morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. By the way, we'll have more from the Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival on next Friday's morning show, so make a note of that. Here's part two of today's program. And we finish out today's If any of you own a dog, like I own a dog, or two dogs, actually, in my case, you need to think very seriously about getting in your hands a wonderful new book called Dog, The Definitive Guide for Dog Owners. It's a beautiful book full of wonderful illustrations, and even more important than all the illustrations and photographs are all the insights that are shared by veterinarian Dr. Bruce Fogel, who is joining me via the telephone from London, England, from his veterinary clinic to talk about this wonderful animal and the way in which they enrich our lives and the way in which we can better care for them. Bruce Fogel has written a number of different books, including The Dog's Mind and 101 Questions Your Dog Would Ask Its Vet. And this latest book is in so many different ways very evidently a labor of love. It's published by Firefly Books, Dog, The Definitive Guide for Dog Owners. And Dr. Bruce Fogel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
I love this book, and I think anyone who owns a dog will deeply appreciate it as I do. I really appreciate a moment in the introduction when, in your words, you take a moment to talk about the species on the other end of the leash. That is not the dog, but the human owner.
Sure.
And you make such an interesting observation there about the typical human being's capacity to connect with dogs. And so often we talk about it in reverse, but I don't ever remember reading a book about dogs which explored this particular matter.
Well, you mentioned I'm a vet. I've been in clinical practice for 40 years. Ended up in London by accident, started off in Toronto, but somehow I ended up here. And after I'd been in practice for, I don't know how long, let's say 7 years, I was getting fairly relaxed at my clinical diagnoses, but I was becoming more questioning about understanding the relationships that I saw between the people who brought dogs in and those dogs. Quite frankly, I didn't understand some of the things that I was seeing and disagreed with some of the things that I saw. I found it tough when somebody would come in and say, I love this dog more than anybody in the whole world, and kiss it on the lips. And I'd go, that's wrong. You've got a family. You've got kids. You've got a husband. How can you love a dog more than any of those people? And in fact, what I was able to do was the Veterinary Association allowed me to organize a symposium, and this was back in 1980, that we called the Human Companion Animal Bond. And what I did was I invited ologists from around the world, psychologists, anthropologists, psychiatrists, sociologists, to talk about the relationship that we have with our pets, dogs and cats primarily, and some other pets. And to look at that relationship from the various different perspectives that they had. And a number of these were dispassionate perspectives. These were people who were interested in why, on any given day, well over half of all North American homes have a dog or a cat. At one point, it was up to 70% of all homes in the States and Canada had dogs or cats. Now, most of those homes had kids. So a dog can't just be a child substitute, because most of those families already have had the real McCoy. So why do we burden ourselves with them financially and emotionally? And it was an eye-opening 3 days for me. One of the things I learned from the psychiatrist when I said, well, I just disagree with some of the stuff I'm seeing, they said, well, you're being judgmental. Why should you impose your judgments on what they're doing? How do you know that what you think is right and what they're doing is wrong? which is a pretty good lesson for a young vet to have.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that came, in my mind, a better appreciation of the hidden values in the relationship we have with dogs. And one of the most interesting was from a cultural anthropologist from MIT, a woman named Connie Perrin. Connie was researching a book on middle-class, middle-American neighboring. And in the process of doing it, Connie, who had never lived with a cat or a dog, found that, as she described it, pets were either the glue or the solvent of neighborly relationships.
Well put.
And that took her off into a delightful tangent on, well, what is it about these animals that make them so popular? Well, she was aware of some research that a man named Aaron Ketcher, a psychiatrist, had done at the University of Pennsylvania, showing that if you stroke your dog, your blood pressure drops, your diastolic blood pressure drops, your state of arousal is diminished, that you get physiological rewards from stroking your own dog. You don't necessarily get them from stroking a dog that you haven't formed a relationship with, but you do from the dog you have formed a relationship with. Ketcher noticed other things as well. He noticed that in his observations at the teaching hospital at the University of Pennsylvania, men would tickle and cuddle and fondle their dogs just as much as women would. And men would very often speak in a voice that was slightly higher. Hello, little doggy. That we're willing to do things like that with our pets, but we feel embarrassed about showing emotion in public with our spouses, for example. So a lot of observational work had been going on in the 70s, and Connie took all of that, and she took work that had been done on parenting and the relationship between the mother and child. It was work that was done by a British psychologist named Winnicott, who did the work on the first work on when the baby is born for the first year, 18 months, the baby thinks that it is part of mummy. And let's say at around 18 months of age, infants start to realize they're not part of mummy, that they have to stand on their own two feet, and that leads to the terrible twos. She pulled all of this together, and she looked at the way people behave with their dogs, that we physiologically get comfort from them in an identical way that the baby gets physiological rewards from touching mummy. She looked at the way owners talk about their dogs. Their dogs can do no wrong, even when we know our dogs have done wrong. My dog didn't poop on your lawn. We know full well that it was our dog that did it. She looked at all of that, how we'll fantasize that our dogs will protect us, that if I fall in the river, my dog's going to jump in and save me. And in reality, if we really think about it, our dogs will jump in because it looks like a giggle rather than to actually save you. And she concluded that pets provide us with a form of love, or what we interpret as love, and something that, in fact, she described as superabundant love, that was quite different from the four or five other types of love that we can experience with our spouses, our parents, our children, our possessions. And she said that in that sense, our pets, in a curious way, are parent substitutes, well as child substitutes.
Wow.
And it was this parent substitution that created such an intense bond. And as society is changing today, and as I've seen it change during the time that I've been in practice, the more I've thought about it, the more I agree with her. There are various things in our culture, and by our culture, I mean Western culture, American, Canadian, British, German, French. There are changes that have occurred in our culture where the totems that held culture together, the three-generation family, the role of religion and of your minister, your priest, these have, in many cases, lost their importance or have disappeared from modern culture. And you could say, in a negative sense, dogs have slipped into the void. dogs and cats, for that matter, will still provide us with a feeling of constancy, of security. They're reliable, they're immutable, they're always there, they're never changing. The world can become a horrible place in many ways, but the dog is always there by your side, understanding you.
And this must be at least one of the main reasons why your observation has been in your practice over the last several decades, that people are becoming more attached, not less attached,
yeah,
to their dogs. I mean,
yeah,
you and your colleagues have observed this.
And did you grow up with dogs?
Yes.
Do you remember where they lived? Because very often, certainly in my generation, the dog had a doghouse outside, and if it was cold, the dog slept in the kitchen, certainly if you had a big dog. And where I lived in Ontario, it was mostly big dogs. But from the kitchen, they moved into the living room and then up onto the sofa, and eventually they migrated into the bedroom. And anybody who's listening who has a dog knows that you give any dog an inch and the dog will be up on the bed, snuggling with you, because that's where they want to be. And where 30 or 40 years ago, that would have been less common, today it's virtually the normal. And you look at something like an Orvis catalog. I just got my Orvis catalog today, which is why it comes to mind. And it isn't just dog beds that they're selling. They're selling things specifically to put on your bed, knowing full well that your dog is going to be sleeping up there. And it's a picture of a Labrador snoozing at the bottom of the bed while the husband and wife are reading. That's just what's changed. And whether it's good or bad, that's not for me to say. And I should interject that I do let my golden retriever up on the bed. So...
Well, and
so I've gone to the far side as well.
Sure. My wife and I would probably do the same, except we have two golden retrievers and literally not enough room for both of them.
Awful lot of dog.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Bruce Fogel, and we're talking about his book, Dog, The Definitive Guide for Dog Owners. And it is a beautiful book full of wonderful photographs and all kinds of interesting information about dogs. In a chapter called What Makes a Modern Dog, you explore a couple of things that I think are often a matter of curiosity for dog owners. And one of them is the matter of intelligence. How intelligent is your particular dog, and how does it compare to the intelligence of your sister-in-law's dog? Versus how about the emotional level of a given dog? Can you talk about those two matters and the way and to what extent we're able to even know about such matters, and also the way in which such things can or should be measured?
There, when we use the word intelligence, if you go into any breed club's definition of their breed, the description of the ideal of that breed, every breed is described as intelligent, and I'm sure... everybody who has written breed descriptions has a different definition of what they mean by intelligence. So, for example, I've got a gold retriever. My two kids who live near me have four Labradors, or almost Labradors, two pure Labradors. One's a lab collie cross, the other's a lab with a smattering of poodle in it. And many people will think these are intelligent dogs, and Stanley Coren, in his excellent book, on, I think called The Intelligence of Dogs, had the Labrador up near the top with the standard poodle and the border collie up at the top. But that definition was really based on trainability, on the ease with which you can train your dog to obey command. Now, some other dog might think a Labrador is just a jerk for being willing to do everything that people ask it to do. And they could. Another dog might think that's the exact opposite of intelligence, that the intelligent dog listens to what it's being instructed to do and goes, well, I understand that, but why should I do it? So I've studiously avoided using the word intelligence in anything that I've written, and I've written a fair bit. There's a little bit of on that. In this book, the publisher first said, write whatever you want, and then, of course, accountants look at the size of a book and said, we have to cut 10% of this book. And so that meant two chapters got cut, and one of them had to do with intelligence. And in fact, anybody who wants to read the cut bit that has not been edited, I stuck it on my website on brucefogel.com. The chapter on intelligence and a chapter on dogs and religion are there. With regard to your question about, with regard to intelligence, you have to define, as far as I'm concerned, we have to define what we mean by it. And dogs will have emotional intelligence, and some have greater emotional intelligence than others. Some will have territorial intelligence. They can map territories far better than others do. Others are absolutely superb at watching our body language and understanding what we mean, to the extent that better than any other species, we can simply look with our eyes in a direction, and a dog can understand that they should follow the gaze of our eyes at something that's down on the ground. And dogs do that better than any primate or better than any other animal. Hmm. As for their emotions, I still meet people who feel that that animals work on autopilot, that only humans have true emotions. And I just can't accept that. I think that the various emotions that we have evolved to serve various purposes in our lives, and animals have those as well. And in fact, there have been wonderful studies showing that even a pigeon can feel jealousy. And so those emotions are there, and we can read them in our dogs fairly readily because dogs use a whole range of body language that is not dissimilar to primate body language. And they're probably even better than we are at reading it in us. They don't have the big frontal cortexes that we have, so they can't think in the abstract way that we can to as sophisticated a degree. So they have to rely on interpreting body language, for example, or scent. Needless to say, they're spectacularly good at picking up scent. But I don't think there's a vet in practice who hasn't been told dozens of times by a pet owner that they might come home from work and they're feeling a bit blue and they sit down and the dog just comes over and lays its head on their lap. And the dog is picking up a signal, it's picking up something in that body language and comes over and makes physical contact. And that's just sociability. They're pack animals. They're sociable, and it's a comforting response that the dog innately has an ability to perform, and that's because they read our emotions so spectacularly well.
I wonder if you could explain to our listeners a very interesting chart that's in a later chapter in the book called "Our Relationship with Dogs," in which it is possible, at least in a fairly rough way, but I think in a way that could be truly meaningful, to actually measure the level of your attachment to your dog. And some interesting questions are posed there and so on. I wonder if you could just explain a little about what this is, and also if you feel like this is something that everybody who owns a dog should do. That is, take this little questionnaire as it is and try to ascertain their level of attachment to a dog. Is there something helpful or useful in knowing that?
Yeah, that was I found when I filled that out, I was actually embarrassed. I think it was the University of Tennessee. I'm pretty certain it was University of Tennessee. Some psychologists there developed an attachment inventory that people could fill out as a self-assessment of their attachment to their pets, with a maximum score, I think, of 30. And I filled it out and I hit 30. Then my wife Julia filled it out, and she hit 30, and my kids filled it out, they all hit 30. And I wondered how valid that was. But it's an accepted self-assessment score to see what your level of attachment is. Now, I'll see in families that the person who brings the dog in, if they filled in that score, would hit 30. And that person very often is the woman in the family. And then her husband might bring the dog in on a different occasion. And if he were to fill in the score, he might hit 21, 22. There will be different levels of attachment. And I think it's very good. It would be fun for families to actually run that and see if there are differences within it. What lots of vets in practice will be confronted with is the distressing situation where you've made a diagnosis of a complicated problem, and treating that problem is going to be expensive. And there's just no way around the fact that it's going to be expensive. It might involve complicated surgery. It might involve expensive drugs. And at that point, that attachment to the pet manifests itself. And for example, that's where I will meet a husband for the first time. The wife and kids will bring the dog in. But now it's a question of money. Should we really invest all of that money when we're struggling to make ends meet in prolonging that dog's life? If you've got a great attachment to it, then the answer is yes, you will. And if you're less attached, then you're more pragmatic about it. So in that sense, I think it's a good score, and I'm delighted that psychologists are actually looking at the relationship between people and animals, not just the relationship between people and people.
Hmm. The book goes on to take us through canine infancy and what you call puppyhood and adolescence, and of course, ultimately, to old age, and ultimately to some of those questions which you were just raising. At some point in the book, you bring up the fact that dogs, of course, live out their lives in a different arc than you and I do, or at least we. That's typically the way it works. That we outlive our dogs, typically by a very significant degree. And I think your book makes that point in a very interesting way, that it's important for us to be aware of that, and in a sense of how rapidly our dogs change and how their needs evolve, and we need to be ready for that.
Yeah, they get to the point where they're geriatric babies, as it were, in the babies in the. They might be have these parenting skills in that they are subconsciously in our minds they provide us with certain values as parents, but we do care for them the way we care for our kids. We take them to the vet when they're not feeling well. We provide them with the security of our home. We want them to be warm. We want their nutrition to be good. And suddenly you've got an old dog. And in fact, of all the things I've written, I wrote an article for a national newspaper in the UK called The Independent, and another national newspaper called The Daily Mail published it the next day. And I had a greater response to that article when quite young dog, a dog that I'd taken on a trip around the States for a book called Travels with Macy. I retraced John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, 40 years after he had done it, with my then golden retriever. And this dog developed a horrible disseminated cancer, and she died at 6 years of age. I wrote an article about the loss of that dog, and the response was overwhelming. And one of the interesting things to me was that on the Daily Mail's webpages, readers logged their comments, and around 75% of those who logged their comments were women. Of the letters that I got, around 75% of the letters were from men. Men didn't want to say in public on a website the torment that they went through when their dog died. But here I was, a guy and a vet, talking about how I felt when my dog died. And they wanted to share with me personally in a letter what they experienced. And I think that may well be on the brucevogel.com website as well from a few years ago. I can't remember. But we have to somehow prepare ourselves, and it's almost impossible to prepare ourselves because they go through this, as you described it aptly, an arc from infancy, which we really don't see because they're with the breeders at that point. And then we get them in what I described as once infancy, that first 6, 7, 8 weeks is over, and we have them through puppyhood, which can be exasperating because we think we've got a dog, but we haven't. We've got a puppy. It's like a different species to a dog. And then the rebellion of adolescence, and the girlies will rebel as well. And those of us who have had male dogs know that some of them take themselves off to tattoo parlors when they're 15 to 18 months of age, and and parts of their personality that you just didn't think was there suddenly comes out. And finally, you get into the calm of adulthood, and that's when dogs are genuinely wonderful fun. But that doesn't last that long. And they suddenly, they're old. And old can mean 8 years of age if you're an Irish wolfhound, or old might not be until you're 14 or 15 if you're a small poodle. Old varies with your size and your breed, but you get there too soon.
Dr. Bruce Fogel's book is called Dog, the Definitive Guide for Dog Owners, published by Firefly Books. The time is 8:56 here on WGTD. And we finish out today's morning show by rewinding, in a sense, with Nan Calvert, who, of course, joins us once a month, usually on Thursday, and was with us yesterday with a fascinating guest, biologist Mabel Garrison, Marla Garrison, talking about dragonflies and damselflies. We had an absolutely riveting, fascinating conversation. We didn't want to cut it short for the calendar of events. So Nan agreed with me that it made more sense to finish that morning show intact and then record the calendar items and share them with you now. So we finish out today's morning show with Nan Calvert's environmental calendar of events. Take it away, Nan.
Thanks. First of all, I want to give a shout out to the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. 2016 is their 30th anniversary year. If you don't know about the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, and it's an organization that you should know something about, they have a terrific website. Just Google Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. For 30 years, they've been providing sustainable funding for Wisconsin's most imperiled species and public lands, while at the same time helping people connect with our state's unique natural places. They fund projects. They offer field trips. They do all kinds of wonderful things. Supporting them is a terrific thing to do for the environment and for Wisconsin. And so that's a great segue into the first announcement, which is on September 10th at Seno Conservancy. We will be doing a workshop called Of Damsels and Dragons, Odonates of Wisconsin, and the terrific Marla Garrison will be our very special guest for that day. That's a Natural Resources Foundation field trip, so you have to be a member of the NRF to attend. But I also have to tell you that it filled within a week of it being publicized, so we'll have to do that again next year. Then on September 17th, we will be having the Woodland Festival Barn Dance and Pig Roast at Seno Conservancy. Registration is required. There will be vendors, a fabulous silent auction, a treasure hunt, wonderful food, including things for vegetarians. And if you'd like to attend, just give me a call at 262-539-3222, or you can email me at nan@senokrlt, that's one word, senokrlt.org. Riverbend Nature Center will be having a full moon paddle. You have to you don't have to bring anything. They'll be providing everything from 7:30 to 9:30. You'll be paddling down the Root River under the moonlight. That sounds like fun. Space is very limited. Registration is required, and you can register by going to the website, or you can call 639-1515. The Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center will be having their fall festival on September 18th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. There will be wonderful food, live music, demonstrations, bake sale, arts and crafts, and alpacas, and don't forget the goats. On August 27th, Weed Out Racine will be found in Colonial Park from 9 a.m. until noon. You'll be out there helping to remove those awful invasive species and save the park from the invaders. You have to bring water and your work gloves. Everything else will be provided. They encourage you to wear long pants. Call 639-0918 for questions and for more details. And that's it.
Very good. Thank you, Nan Calvert. We look forward to seeing you in September.
I look forward to it, too. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
You bet. The morning show airs every weekday morning between